It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Congress begins its lame duck session today. We'll take a look at the agenda, which includes things like the Keystone XL pipeline and Ebola funding. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Last year, the Lady Thunderhawks varsity basketball team became the first team to win a regional championship in the history of the Oneida Nation High School. The team combines standard training with traditional cultural practices and is a source of pride for their community. Team captain Jessica House shares her love of the game.
I started playing ball when I was 8 years old. I just had a really big passion to play basketball for Oneida Nation. Basketball is my life, and so is the culture. My name is Jessica House. I am a senior, and I play for the Lady Thunderhawks. To be a Lady Thunderhawk, you have to learn discipline. I mean, your role models. You gotta think about how you're acting out in public. In order to play basketball at Oneida, you have to be in the culture. You have to participate. Not a lot of girls were raised into it where I was, but they are starting to find their ways now, and some of them even come to Longhouse now. It's important because I think it helps know who they really are, because sometimes you get so caught up in the other world. There's other girls, like me and Tasha, we take separate classes out of school for an actual language class. Our teacher, Sully Hope, when he was younger, there was more of the elders around that spoke the language, whereas now we don't really hear it.
Have you learned it?
Sully Hope teaches us words to say. Every time we go in for a huddle, we go, we have 11 girls on the Lady Tiat team. I am captain. I'm also the point guard, so I'm expected to keep the game going, keep everyone under control, keep myself under control. Before, we had hardly any people in the stands. My sophomore year, the fans started to fill in. My parents only missed one game out of the 3 years I've been at Oneida. I think it's really cool when all the parents are there supporting their daughters. It gives us our energy. I don't know how the other girls see it, but there's no better feeling than when I play basketball.
This story was produced by Finn Ryan for The Ways. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30 p.m. Now it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today Politics Editor Paul Singer. Today is the first day of the new lame duck session. It's the last chance for Congress to pass legislation before the new members are inaugurated in January. On the docket, a possible Keystone XL pipeline vote, government funding, and Ebola aid. And as the world got news of a new agreement between the U.S. and China on climate change, so did Congress, and not all members were happy. In fact, Mitch McConnell was pretty upset. Paul Singer joins us now, as he joins us every week at this time. Paul, it's great to have you here. Thank you.
How you doing, Veronica? Good to be have the Congress back to play with.
Well, right. So lame duck Congress beginning. Is there any legislation that Congress needs to pass before the end of the session?
Well, yeah. The first thing that everybody agrees they have to pass is the government funding runs out December 11th. So it is very clear that nobody wants the government to shut down. Mitch McConnell, the new Senate Majority Leader, or will be new in January, said clearly there will be no shutdowns. Now, the question is, what does that mean? Do they pass another short-term spending bill for a couple of months, get it into January, February, and then take it up with the new Congress? Or do they pass a bill that includes the entire year funding through September 2015, which the Democrats are heavily advocating for, of course, because the Democrats still control the majority. So they have to pass something. What it will be, it remains a bit of a mystery.
So that is a must-do on the list. Are there other things that are looking interesting to Congress, but maybe not as pressing?
Yeah, there's a couple things that are still very high on the list. Well, for starters, President Obama has requested $6 billion for Ebola, emergency funding for Ebola. This will probably be wrapped up in whatever the funding bill is. But this is a critical thing that I think both parties want to see move as quickly as possible. Republicans are saying basically they want to make sure it's spent properly, but nevertheless they still want to move this legislation as fast as they can. And then the other one is also a spending portion, is for the war against ISIS. So, you know, we're going to need several billion dollars to continue bombing runs and now, you know, more advisors on the ground in Iraq and Syria to be assisting the Iraqi army in fighting off the Islamic State terrorists. So those things everybody wants to get moving. Republicans have some other agenda items on the list that are sort of interesting. There are some tax cuts that expire. If those are not extended by the end of the year, it would essentially turn into a retroactive tax hike. So Republicans are trying to make sure they tackle those. There's some bills, little bills that most folks wouldn't have heard about, like a terrorism insurance bill, stuff like that, that has to get done by the end of the year. These are all things that bills were written previously with the end of December deadlines, and now those deadlines are coming to bear, and if we don't get these bills passed, bad things happen.
Now, this is considered, as we said, a lame duck Congress. What typically happens during times like this? Is it really just as fallow a period as it can be?
You know, it's interesting. This lame duck will be particularly interesting because you're converting from Senate control by the Democrats to Senate control by the Republicans in January. And what makes that interesting is that the Democrats now in the Senate want to get as much done as possible so that the bills that pass with a Democratic stamp on them. The Republicans want to prevent passage of as much legislation as possible so they can wait till their Republican reinforcements arrive in January and they can write a better bill. So it's this really interesting push and pull. You know, one of the things that Democrats are likely to do is try and get a bunch of Obama appointees confirmed while they still have the majority, under the theory that it'll be a lot harder to get those people confirmed for judicial appointments, particularly once Republicans take charge.
But hearings on appointees, that can take a lot of time and be a drawn-out process. Is that something that's feasible?
Hearings? What are these things you call hearings? The beauty of the Senate, of course, is that there are no real rules. So, you know, if the majority leader, who for the next 6 weeks or so is still Harry Reid from Nevada, still a Democrat, if he wants to march a couple of these things up onto the floor for a vote, a couple of these names of people to the floor for a vote, he can do it. And he may have the votes to win.
He may have the votes to win, but it's never that simple, is it?
Well, no, but keep in mind that this year they changed the rules on some of these nominees, so you no longer need 60 votes, you only need 51, which drove Republicans insane when they did it, when they changed the threshold for these nominees. These are sort of the, you know, sub-cabinet, non-Supreme Court nominees, other judicial nominees. That's exactly why they did it, because they couldn't get any of these things passed, and so they said, well, to heck with it, we will just lower the threshold. Now, that's the kind of threshold that they could actually probably muster during the lame duck, because all the Democrats realize that starting in January, they will be the minority and will have almost no rights at all.
And given that, the fact that, you know, the Democrats could do something like this, try to get some nominees out there for the Democrats before they're out of power, would that be sort of a gesture at this point of bad faith, something that might, to use some language I've seen today, poison the well, get sort of animosity going between the two parties before they go forward, or is this just what you do?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. They were all singing Kumbaya 3 days ago, but, you know, I've been covering Washington for 30 years. The well here has never been particularly clear water to start with, and, you know, it's just a matter of time. I mean, at the moment, Senator Mary Landrieu raced to the floor, literally within, you know, minutes of Harry Reid opening the session, and announced her plan to bring a bill up to approve the Keystone Pipeline. And, you know, this is the big north-south pipeline bringing oil down from tar pits in Canada. Well, it's funny about Mary Landrieu bringing this to the floor, and she's still on the floor now. She's been up there for an hour talking about this thing, because she is the unsettled seat in the Senate. She did not win her reelection. She's in a runoff. And the runoff is against a guy named Congressman Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. Well, so Mary Landrieu's on the Senate floor saying we should vote right now on this XL pipeline bill.
Because she thinks this is going to help her in the election, in the runoff.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's giving her several opportunities, and several other members several opportunities, to stand up and say, by the way, I'm the chair of the Energy Committee, which matters to Louisiana. And other senators stand up and say, I'd like to congratulate my good friend Mary Landrieu, the chairman of the Energy Committee, which is helpful to Louisiana, for bringing up this bill. Well, House Republicans responded and said, okay, fine, we'll bring up the bill tomorrow. And it's a bill sponsored by, wait for it, Bill Cassidy, your opponent in the Senate race.
Wow. So interesting maneuvering going on. So should she succeed in bringing this bill, does that endear her to anyone, voters, environmentalists?
Who knows? I think the theory is, and it's a good theory, she has to win an election in about 3 weeks. Being able to stand on the floor, introduce a bill, get it passed for something that's very popular in her state, because, you know, Louisiana is very heavily reliant on the petrochemical industry. So you're able to stand on the floor and pass this bill and get praise for it and say, see, I can still achieve things in the Congress. You need to keep me here. It certainly can't hurt. Whether it really helps or not is a different story. I mean, she's considered to be a serious underdog for that race.
We're talking right now with USA Today's Paul Singer, politics editor, and we're talking about Congress right now. The lame duck session has begun. We're talking about some of those things which are on the table, things that could possibly happen, possibly a vote on the Keystone XL pipeline, talking about some potential funding for Ebola, some action perhaps on ISIS, some budget action. And coming up, we're going to talk about the reaction to the U.S.-China climate change carbon emissions deal that we just heard about, talking about that as well as we continue. We're talking Congress right now with USA Today's politics editor, Paul Singer, talking about what's on the table for the so-called lame duck Congress, which is in session as of right now. And Paul, one thing we want to talk about is the news that President Obama had made an agreement with China on climate change. Was that also news to the legislature?
Yeah. Everybody was taken by some surprise, and it will not surprise you to know that the Republicans particularly were not particularly happy to hear about this. President Obama announced late last night, the White House announced late last night, that they had reached this deal with China to cut greenhouse gas emissions. I should note, it's not really a binding deal. I mean, it's kind of like a plan to do these things. It's not actually a commitment to specific steps. Nevertheless, this morning, Republicans responded pretty negatively. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, you know, this is exactly the kind of executive, unilateral executive action we don't want this president taking. He said that he heard the message from voters that he wants the president to work with Congress to solve problems. This is not working with us. This is unilateral executive action. And by the way, McConnell, of course, you know, the way that you cut greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in the United States, is you start cutting down on coal-powered power plants, coal-fired power plants. Well, McConnell's entire reelection campaign was based on this notion of we will fight for coal. We will save coal from Obama's bad EPA. So when Obama then announces, oh, we're going to, you know, cut more climate change, cut more global warming emissions, it's basically a direct challenge to McConnell saying, hey, we're going to continue regulating coal and trying to shut down some of these plants.
Now, why wasn't Congress more involved in something like this? These talks were billed as 9 months of secret talks. So I guess why the secrecy?
because you want to achieve something. I mean, the beauty of any kind of international negotiation, but particularly when you're dealing with the Chinese, they just don't have these conversations in public. Because the minute, of course, John Kerry would have said, oh, yeah, I'm meeting with the foreign minister of China to work on a deal on climate change, of course, Republicans would have been up in arms then as well and would have done everything to stop it. So there was no, I mean, secrecy was the only way you get to a deal. Now, of course, that also means you have absolutely no buy-in for the deal from anybody on the other side. And I think what's going to happen is the first thing the Republican Congress will do is pass some sort of a rider on a spending bill saying you shall not spend any federal money to implement new greenhouse gas reductions, period.
Right. So do you expect this to be weakened, this action that has happened, by some legislation down the road? And if that happens, does that mean China on their end weakens their commitment?
Well, you know, these commitments, of course, like I said, they're not really binding. I'm not sure how specific they are. And not being an expert in climate policy, I couldn't really tell you exactly what these deals entail. But, yeah, I mean, I'm almost certain the Congress will take some sort of steps to try and thwart any new regulations or any new restrictions from the Obama administration. Now, does that mean that China then backs away and says, well, you know, your Congress wouldn't do? I don't know. But, yes, I would be stunned if the Republican Congress did not take action to try and reverse whatever deal it is Obama has reached with the Chinese.
It's an interesting case that the secrecy, as you said, is a necessity. On the other hand, you look at something like the Iran nuclear talks, where there seemed to be a lot, maybe if not transparency, something closer to that, where a lot of people were weighing in along the process, which is ongoing. What's the difference?
Well, part of the difference is that there are very few Americans who have an economic interest in seeing Iran get a nuclear weapon. On the other hand, there are a lot of Americans who have a direct economic interest in avoiding stricter environmental regulations. So, I mean, it's a pocketbook issue to some degree, particularly in places like Kentucky where you mine coal. Coal has been an extraordinarily profitable part of American industry for 150 years or more, but it pollutes. It is a dirty fuel. And for folks in Kentucky, the view has been all along that the effort to address climate change is, quote, a war on coal, unquote, and a war on our pocketbooks. That is a reason to get up and fight. Iran having a nuclear weapon, even in rural Kentucky, they don't want that.
There has been criticism of China for not putting out harder numbers about their commitment, for instance, saying they're going to cut coal emissions, which is key to their story there as well. The United States is reliant on coal, and so is China. Do you see any reason to believe that is going to be a sticking point for both nations?
Well, again, see, now here you get into climate policy, which I know nothing about. I know much more about the politics of it. What I can tell you is that, you know, China has an advantage, an inherent advantage in implementing any of these kind of agreements, which is this. They don't have to go through a democratic process to get it approved. They don't have to go through their Congress to get sign-off on new restrictions on coal, or they probably don't have to go through fairly remarkable restrictions to build a new nuclear power plant, for instance, more or less wherever they want to. Democracy is a complicated business, and it makes it very hard to do decisive things. So, to some degree, I'd have more expectation of the Chinese being able to execute their side of a deal than I would the U.S., because they don't have to go to a vote to get it done.
Now, in our last little bit of time here, I want to talk about immigration. Now, this is one that has been punted down the road for a long time.
Right.
Is there any hope on any kind of action here? Maybe, perhaps, as President Obama has foreshadowed, an executive action.
This is the great drama that we're awaiting. Obama has promised that he's going to take executive action on immigration because, he says, the Congress has failed to do so. The Republicans who will be leading the new Congress and who, you know, are in charge of the Republicans in the current Congress have said, this will poison the well, as they say. This will prevent any kind of legislation from passing, with the possible exception of legislation to undo whatever Obama does by executive authority. They are very concerned about this. Their argument is basically, you cannot do by executive fiat what we have been, you know, trying to negotiate through Congress. Obama's response is, you have not been trying to negotiate this through Congress. You've just been trying to kill it, and I can't let you stall forever. There's 11 million people who need some sort of clarity about their status. We don't know whether we are actually going to get an executive order out of Obama before Christmas, but that has been the promise, and that is what he said he's going to do. Obviously, immigration advocates are breathing down his neck to get this thing done and to release something as soon as possible.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Veronica. Have a great day.
You too. We've been speaking with Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He speaks with us every week at this time to talk Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, advice for parents who find out that their child is gay and want to keep being supportive and building a strong parent-child relationship. First, for the next 5 weeks, we're talking about death in America. Madison's Dan Perotti was a Lutheran minister who'd been living with congestive heart failure for 25 years, so he had a long time to think about and even to plan his death. To the best of our knowledge, producer Seth Jovog followed Dan Perotti and his wife Judy during the final 10 months of his life, from his terminal diagnosis to his death and burial.
Death doesn't bother me anyway. It's part of life, and I don't even think I'm worried about that. I'm not looking forward to it, but I certainly don't care. You can't destroy matter. It becomes something else. It becomes energy. You can't destroy energy. That's what I am. I'm just a bunch of matter and energy put together in a certain way. And I believe that when I'm buried, dead and buried, ultimately all these pieces of me, whatever they are, molecules, genome, the whole thing, will convert to some other energy or some other mass or some other thing. Maybe I'll be a tree.
Do you think that's what you'll be?
I have no idea.
If you had your choice, what would you like to be?
Oh, I don't know. It's just some energy floating around doing something.
So what's happening now? Why is it?
Because I made the decision that I didn't want to continue just sort of living on the edge of, in the hospital, out of the hospital, a burden on everybody. I'm in the stage of being pretty much content with the decision to prepare to die rather than to fight to stay alive.
He turned inward more and more and more. And we would sit and have a meal together, and he hardly spoke. He just didn't have it in him anymore. By Tuesday, he had slipped into a coma, and he lived all day Saturday, he lived all day Sunday, he lived half of Monday. We were all there with him. We were all holding onto him, and we were crying. It was very sad, but it was very beautiful. And he just took his last breath, and then he was gone. Where is Dan now? Oh, this is a question I've struggled with my entire adult life, and I still don't have an answer. I too believe that we can't totally disappear. So there's something there. Oh, I feel his presence a lot. I feel his absence. I feel both his presence and his absence. Yeah.
That's Judy Perotti speaking about the death of her husband, Dan Perotti. Their story is part of To the Best of Our Knowledge's five-part series called Simply Death. You can hear the first hour of the series tonight at 6 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming out as gay to family can be one of the most daunting moments in a child's life, and for parents, it can be hard to find the right words. How can parents respond appropriately to a child sharing the news, how to deal with their own personal beliefs, and how to help gay kids deal with discrimination and keep communication lines open? Those are a handful of the questions that our next guest tackles. With me now in studio is Kristen Russo, co-founder of the website Everyone is Gay and the author of This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids. Kristen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen, you came out to your parents when you were 17. Tell us how your parents handled it.
Well, I came out to my parents over Thanksgiving dinner, so don't do that to anyone listening who's thinking about it. And my parents were, you know, their first words were that they loved me and they would always love me. But my mom was raised in a very religious household, as were we, and so she struggled for a very long time with her faith and with then knowing that her daughter was gay.
And you said, don't come out to your parents over Thanksgiving. Why not?
I mean, I'm being a little silly, you know, do what you think is best. But I certainly would have preferred if our conversation had happened not in like the chaos that can be a holiday. I do think it's a time when a lot of young people come out, especially because for me, I was home from college. So it was the time, you know, and then I was going to go away again. So I do think Thanksgiving and, you know, the winter holidays, that's a big time when people come out.
So how did you end up writing this book? This is a book for parents of gay kids. Well, how did this come about?
Well, Danielle, my business partner and also the co-author of the book, and I have had Everyone is Gay for over 4 years. And we've been dialoguing with young lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth for, you know, all of that time and started to realize there was a common thread to their questions. They would come up to us after college events, after high school events, and then online would ask us, you know, can you please create something for my parents? Can you make a video? Can you come out to me? Can you come out to my parents for me? And so we looked and to see what was there and we didn't find very much. And so our nature is to kind of do it if it hasn't been done.
So you say you didn't find very much. Why do you think there wasn't some simple common sense, you know, how-tos both for parents and for gay kids?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there have been books written. This certainly isn't the first book to ever tackle the topic, but so many of the books that are out there are written in the 70s or 80s, and they're super outdated. And then a lot of the other materials are very clinical in their approach, which isn't a bad thing, but, you know, a lot of parents and families want something to read that is not going to be simply clinical.
And so this ended up being geared toward parents, as your book title states. What is it that parents wanted to know? And were you surprised when they started joining this community and you started hearing from them instead of the gay kids?
I wasn't surprised because, you know, having gone through the coming out experience myself, I knew how many questions my mom and my dad both had during the process. But I think that, you know, Danielle and I had a large pool of parents when we were writing the table of contents, and it was really, really interesting to hear what some of their questions were. Some of them we knew, you know, is it a phase? We knew was a common question. But will my child be more promiscuous? I didn't think was still a question that parents had, and they did.
So going back to that very first moment for a parent when their child tells them they're gay, what are some of the things that can go wrong for parents, and what advice can you give them to fix some of those landmines?
You know, I think that for everyone involved in a coming out moment, it tends to be a little awkward, especially if it takes a parent by surprise. They may say something or ask something that they didn't want to say or ask. And so I think the first part of it is just forgiving yourself if you do say something you didn't mean to say, and know that you can always go back to your child and say, hey, I was surprised. I was taken off guard. I said these things, but what I actually mean is this. I think just knowing that you have that wiggle room and that what you say in that first moment isn't the end all be all. Coming out is a process. It's not just a moment.
And one thing you recommend, though, is not to ask the unfortunate question, are you sure?
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, I think that it takes away some power from your child. And there's a good chance that they may know very sure that they are gay, but there's also a chance that they aren't quite sure. And that shouldn't really matter. You know, as a parent, your kid is coming to you and they're sharing a very, very important part of themselves with you. And so even if they're not 100% sure, it's their acceptance is what they're looking for. They're looking for the acceptance of their parents, regardless of the certainty of the matter.
And there's so many angles on this that you take. And one of the questions you get is, what if, as a parent, I accidentally discover that my child is gay before they've come out to me? How do I handle that?
And I think, again, you know, coming out for the young person is a really important moment. It's a moment of ownership, and it can only happen when your child is ready. So if you accidentally discover something, as much as you can, keep that to yourself. Or, you know, if you have a close friend or you want to tell your spouse or something like that and have a conversation, that's fine. But asking your child outright or saying that you found something can be really upsetting, especially if they're not ready yet to be out to you, or if they're just not sure yet what their identity is.
And you have some advice in the scenario like that, where you say one thing that you could try is creating an atmosphere that's welcoming to a child who may down the road be coming out, without saying, hey, are you gay, which is coming at it, you know, right from the front, but just to create the atmosphere. How do you go about doing that?
Exactly. I mean, I think that, you know, I personally want to title the book, This is a Book for Parents of Kids, because I think that the most important part is creating accepting and welcoming environments, no matter the sexuality of your child. It's important regardless, because even if your kid is non-LGBTQ, they're going to be accepting of other people in the community if they have that environment. And it's really easy in this day and age to create that environment, because there's so much happening in the news alone. You know, you can bring up marriage equality in your home. You can bring up what's happening, you know, with the Catholic faith and the Pope, and all of these things are so many talking points. So just bringing it up in context of what's happening in the world around us is a great way to say that you're accepting and loving of people regardless of their sexuality or gender identity.
And one difficult aspect of this can be a parent whose religious views run contrary to what their child may be telling them. What advice do you have there?
Well, I went through that personally with my own mom, and so the religion chapter was actually very important for me. And I think that the most important thing for a parent of faith who's struggling with their beliefs to know is just don't close your door to your child. You know, as long as you can keep the communication open, it's okay if you have to go through a process. And it's also not out of the realm of possibility for you to have differing beliefs as your child and still love and respect them for who they are.
And so is that something that can, I imagine, take a bit of time? You start with not wanting to damage that relationship, but maybe move toward a place of greater understanding together.
Yeah, it took my mom and I, you know, almost 10 years to get to a place of deeper understanding. And that wasn't all, you know, yelling, crying time, but it was a journey for us. And I think it's different for everyone. But resources are so critical. Knowing, you know, my mom didn't have very many resources. And I think that if people of faith know that there are welcoming congregations, that there are plenty of LGBTQ people who are people of very deep faith, those are all very important pieces as a parent to have when you're working through that journey.
We're talking right now about parenting gay kids, learning what strategies can best help when parents communicate and support their gay children. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Are you a gay person who has come out to your parents? And what went well? What do you wish had gone a little bit differently? And what advice do you have maybe for parents who are grappling with this? And for parents on the flip side, what would you like to know about how to handle this territory and what worked in your life? Call 800-642-1234. We're exploring tips and strategies right now for parents with gay children, and we'd like you to weigh in. Are you the parent of a gay child? And what did you find most difficult to deal with when your child first came out to you? And what strategies do you find helpful in communicating with and supporting your child? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us a tweet. Our handle is @CentralTimeWPR. Kristen Russo stays with us now. She's co-founder of the website Everyone is Gay and the author of the book, This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids. And we're going to take a first caller now. John is with us from Grand Rapids. Hi, John.
Hi. I kind of jumping in the middle. I'm sorry if you've addressed this. Your book deals with the child-parent relationship, and I had kind of a different perspective. My brother is gay, and he kind of got outed by his friends before he was ready to do that. I don't know what's the best timing or advice for the sibling perspective, but this is decades ago. I kept it a secret for over 10 years because he didn't want our mother to know. Just the different view. I wonder what your thoughts or concerns are about that and how times have changed with this issue as well.
Great questions. Thank you, John. And Kristen, what would you say to that one?
Yeah, well, you're definitely right about times changing in the last decade. You know, things are different and acceptance is at a different level in the country and in the world. But I think that, you know, what you did by respecting your brother's wishes was actually the right call. I mean, I would have told you, you know, to tell a friend, a close friend, at least somebody that you could talk to about it. But ultimately, when somebody is outed against their will and they don't want to be out yet, it's really important to respect that. And I think that you were probably the best brother you could have been by respecting that with him.
Okay, well, thank you so much, John. Hope that helps. And Kristen, you said one of the most common questions is
it a phase?
Is it a phase? Yeah, that's something that parents often respond with then, right? Or is that something they're asking you?
Well, no, they ask their child usually directly, or maybe not ask, but say, okay, I know you think this now, but it's a phase. I'm sure it'll go away. And they've asked us as well, what do I do if I think it's a phase? And, you know, Danielle and I always say that even if it is, like, first of all, what does that word even mean? But even if your child is not the person they are today in 5 years, that doesn't really make a difference. Who they are today is who they say they are today, and none of us can predict the future. So even if you think your child may not be a lesbian in 5 years, they're telling you they're a lesbian right now, and so accepting them for that is the most important part.
Is that difficult for parents to do? As a parent, you see so many things come and go, you know, tattoos, mohawks, I don't know, hanging out with different social groups. Is that something hard for parents to wrap their heads around, that that's maybe not the right question at this moment?
I think it is hard for parents to wrap their head around their child's sexuality or gender identity being different than they had thought it was going to be, because as a parent, you create a picture for what you think your child's future is going to look like. And it's really hard when that picture isn't lining up. But, you know, ultimately, even if you are right as the parent and your child isn't going to be a lesbian in 5 years, by you accepting them for who they are, they know to accept other people for who they are as well. So, you know, I think it's a kind of no harm, no foul situation if you're just showing your child love and acceptance.
Now, once parents have made peace with the news, how can they maintain a healthy dialogue with their children going forward?
Well, we like to say to be consistent. You know, if you're a parent who's always discussed things at the dinner table, keep doing that. If you're the kind of parent that elbows your kid in the ribs and says, isn't that guy cute? Do the same thing, but say, girl, you know, just maintain the human that you were before they came out, and then get informed. I think our book is a great starting point because it has a really expansive resources section in the back, too. So after you read the book, you have new places you can watch documentaries, read books, things like that, to bring in more information, because the more information you have, the better picture you can put together in your head of what your kid's future might look like.
And one thing going forward, once your child is out to you, they may want to be out in a broader circle. Maybe that involves coming out at school as well. And parents, I know, have gotten in touch with you and said, you know, is this safe? Is this something, you know, do I have to worry about my kid being bullied or, you know, even physical violence? How do you navigate those waters?
Well, that's a really tricky thing. And that was my dad's biggest concern, was would I be safe? And I think that as the parent, the first thing to look into is what resources are available at your kid's school, and ask your kid directly, do they have a gay straight alliance? Do they have something in the school? Are there allies there for them? You know, that's the biggest piece, because even if your child does face discrimination in school, if there are teachers, a principal, administrators or groups that support them, they will likely have the support they need to meet other people going through those things. So that's really, really critical.
Now, you're doing an event tonight at 7 o'clock at the UW-Madison. What are you going to be focusing on?
Tonight, actually, is a really special event for us. It's a college-focused event. So we'll be reading from the book, but the focus that Danielle and I bring to college campuses is trying to talk to young people about how accessible it is to make change. I think that there are so many people who think that the only way to make change is by becoming a full-time activist, and that's not the case. You know, even if all you do is make the commitment to be kind to everyone around you, that is in itself a huge act of change.
Is that what you mean on your website when you say everyone is gay?
Well, when we named Everyone is Gay, it was supposed to be a silly thing, but now it is. You know, Everyone is Gay symbolizes to Danielle and I that so many of the concerns and feelings that we have are very similar to those around us. If I'm afraid to come out to my parents, it's because I want their acceptance. And a lot of us can understand wanting the acceptance of our families, regardless of our sexuality or gender identity.
And so what would you say to people about those basic building blocks of human acknowledgement and kindness, no matter, you know, what you're talking about in terms of gender identity, gay, straight, LGBTQ, what have you?
I think that the most important thing to remember is just to really apply the being kind to everything. I think a lot of us think that being kind might mean being kind to our friends, or being kind might mean being kind just to non-celebrities and being, there are so many levels of being kind and being respectful that I think it's just constantly being on guard and constantly being aware of your surroundings and of how you're treating the world and the people around you.
Do you think that's something that young people in particular are struggling with right now?
I do. I think it's something that we all struggle with, not just young people. I think that for a lot of us, the easy thing is to say you're different and I have these thoughts about that difference that are negative. And I think that especially for young kids, Danielle and I spoke in a middle school yesterday, and you know, they were telling us some of the things that they do to each other, and it's just not nice at all, and it hurts them so deeply. And I think that letting people know that being kind is okay and is a big deal is so important.
Now, as we wrap up here, any additional resources besides your book that you want to steer parents or kids to, families?
Yeah, well, PFLAG is an organization that's been around since the 70s, and they do a lot of really great on-the-ground community work. So if you're at a place as a parent or a family member of an LGBTQ person where you feel like you want to meet other people in that position in your community, you can go to a local PFLAG chapter and sit down and talk with other people in person. So we offer the book and the online presence, and PFLAG does a really great job of in-person.
Terrific. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Kristen Russo, co-founder of the website Everyone is Gay and author of the book This is a Book for Parents of Gay Kids. You can catch Kristen and her co-author, Danielle Owens-Reed, at a public talk at the UW-Madison tonight at 7 o'clock. For details about that event, you can go to their website, Everyone is Gay.